Numbers, the 14th chapter. And let's begin reading from God's most holy word in verse 20. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice. They shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurn me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he's had a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring him into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I've heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, As I live, says the Lord, just as you've spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do it to you. Your corpses will fall in this wilderness. Even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said will become prey, I will bring them in. And they will know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in this wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness, according to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days. For every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. Let's pray. Lord, let us take serious this passage before us, knowing the God behind it. Let us come without question. Let us come as Job did, putting our hands over our mouths. Dare we question a God who's been so patient? Let us know at the beginning, Lord, speak to us in your spirit to confirm the truth that the amazing thing in the Bible is not that you kill, is not that you destroy, and it is not that there is a hell, but that you save, that you're merciful, that you're patient, and that there is a heaven that will one day be filled with a multitude of redeemed which no man can number. Give us eyes to see, Lord. Give us hearts to believe. Give us minds to understand, and give us wills to obey and heed. For Christ's sake, amen. Well, any study of the book of Numbers has to understand where God's plan has gone and where it's going. Numbers is written by Moses, you probably know, who is alive at this time to witness the events he records for us in this book. And he records for us the events not just in this book, but the first 5 books of the Bible, sometimes called the Pentateuch because of 5, or the book of Moses, the books of Moses. These 5 books lay out for us the foundational promises and the foundational themes that will now be weaved throughout the rest of the Bible. So it's important to put together both the chronology of what's going on here in Numbers and the geography, we could say, that's transpiring. We could say that Genesis 12, the time from which God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees in hope of a promised land to come, Genesis 12 to Deuteronomy is something like a travel manifest. It's something like a record of geography. There's a geographical charting of God's people throughout Genesis 12 to the end of Deuteronomy as God moves his people out of Ur of the Chaldees and into the promised land called Canaan. Over 400 years from calling to just starting to enter the land. 400 years. The basic geography from Ur to Canaan goes something like this. In the book of Genesis, Abraham moves from Ur and then his descendants to Egypt. The geography of Genesis is Ur to Egypt. We could back up a little bit further and say Garden of Eden, but really from Genesis 12 and the promise, the calling of Abraham, we have from Ur to Egypt about 250 years. The book of Exodus gives us the geography of Egypt, leaving there, heading to Mount Sinai. Over 120 years of the beginning of Exodus to the end of God putting his people in that place of Mount Sinai. Leviticus, the book of the priesthood, is really all set at the base of Mount Sinai, lasting only 1 year in time. This helps us to get a grasp on these five books so that we understand these plates fit together. We understand the chronology isn't just chaos. That this isn't sometimes telling the same story twice. There's some overlap at times, but really we can see it in a chronology and geographical sense that helps us to lay out something of the order of God's plans. Numbers, the book we look at today, moves us from Mount Sinai to Moab. So notice that the people for some time have spent a good bit at the base of Mount Sinai. God's provision in the wilderness was either before Mount Sinai or after Mount Sinai, but Mount Sinai was at least a year of God setting up the principles of the priesthood. The people there not needing manna so much, as able to hunt, as able to set up crops, as able to be not so nomadic, not so sojourning in their travels. So Deuteronomy is really just set at the plains of Moab. If Numbers is this wilderness wanderings, Deuteronomy hits pause. And the story is not advanced in the book of Deuteronomy. Picture it this way. There's the book of Numbers, and at the end of Numbers, you have Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law, and we'll look at that next week. But notice, before they enter the land, Moses stops to preach, and he preaches Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is his message to the people, confirming to them what God requires as they prepare now to enter the land. Numbers is this thing of moving out in the wilderness for 40 years. Remember God's 4P purposes. We've covered these so many times. They're there as a fill-in-the-blank again for you, because if you write them down, you'll be more apt to memorize these. These are the four main threads, we could say, that are weaved throughout the pages of the whole Bible. That God has a people. That God is putting them in a distinct place. That God there is revealing a distinct and more powerfully real presence of himself. And there with those people in that place, with his presence, he is setting up principles. Principles that are both promises of hope and laws of command and threat, warning. Just to remind you about the Saturday seminar coming up, just 6 days from now, you can still sign up for that. But this is the kind of thing that we like to do in a biblical theology. We're tracing themes and threads for the whole Bible to say, how does it fit together? This isn't just 66 chops, 66 various books. It's not just a compendium of various authors, religious Christian authors and some Jewish authors. And here you go, here's the book for it. This is a divinely authored book. There is one God behind it. And one God behind it means that it has one story, that it has themes that connect and are developed. And so we keep those P's in mind as we think about the book of Numbers. God is now bringing his people into the place he has promised, where there he will reveal more of his presence. It will be the city of God as we come to know it in David's time. God has been revealing his principles in the book of Exodus, the law of Moses, the promises of Abraham. Abraham believed God and it was counted to him unto righteousness. This is a principle that will be weaved through the whole Bible. And so when we come to Numbers, the first thing we ask is, why is it called Numbers? Numbers? Well, there are a lot of numbers in it. And really, it's called Numbers first and foremost because twice in the book, God commands his people to take a census. to find out how many people there are. Chapter 1 of Numbers begins with a census, a God-commanded census. What are we up against? How many do we have? They have 2 million plus people. 2 million plus. The army itself, men 20 years and older, over 600,000 now. Remember, God's about to bring them into the land. We've already seen in the book of Genesis and the book of Exodus that they will have to take it by storm, by conquest. God's sizing up the army for them. Guys, you have 600,000 strong. As you get ready to enter the land, notice what you have. Why would God have them count? Yes, on a human level, God would have them count because first and foremost, as we think about the thematic plan of God in the Scriptures, what was one of the promises given to Abraham? What was one of the threads weaved throughout the Bible? His people. Distinctly with Abraham, it's the promises given to Abraham, one of which is many people, a multitude of people. It's even Abraham's name, the father of a multitude. And so now this is God counting his promises and his fulfillment. This is the proof, as it were, to the people. See, I told you Abraham's seed would be many. How many? Well, now we're at 2 million strong, an army of 600,000. And so as they head into the land, yes, on a human level, God is having the people size up their army. You don't go into battle to lose. You look at your army, you say, what do we have? Can we do it? But there's another theme here too, another reason why God has them count. One that's actually even more fleshed out in the book of Numbers than the first reason to count up the army to see if it can stand against the enemy. The first reason is that, but the second reason is fleshed out as we walk through 8 major themes in the book of Numbers. These 8 major themes show us the answer to the question, why count? God, why count? Why call it numbers? Why make us find out how many we have? Well, we'll get to that. But the first major theme in Numbers is preparation. Chapters 1 through 10 is preparation. We've already talked about the preparation by counting. Chapter 1 is counting. Chapter 2 is camps, organizing various camps. The tribes have to be organized in their camps. Imagine moving 2 million people in the desert. How do you know when to go? Albuquerque, 600,000. Imagine the mayor says, we're moving. And this is before TV. He doesn't go on and do a public broadcast announcement. He gets 2 million people to leave to know when to go. So they're set up into camps and there are horn blowers to know when to move and in which direction to go. But there's also not just practical preparation. There is spiritual preparation. There's a preparation that's not by counting. There's a preparation by cleansing. So chapters 3 through 10 remind the people of purity, of the laws God has commanded, of the priestly duties. And then chapter 10 actually ends with these hopeful, promising, even worshipful words. Look at verses 35 and 36 of Numbers 10. It came about when the ark set out that Moses said, rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered and let those who hate you flee before you. When it came to rest, he said, when the ark came to rest, he said, return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. This is hope in God. This is hope in God's promised land. This is hope in God's promised victory. This is hope in God's promised many people. But look at chapter 11, verse 1. Oh, how fickle. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity. And the Lord heard it. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. Immediately you move from preparation to complaint. In one verse you move from
hopeful preparation to move into the land, and then, oh, it changes. The people complain, and God is killing them.
Remember the geography here. They're heading out from the base of Mount Sinai. They've been there a year. They've gotten a little settled. They've got their crops. They've got their hunting routines, their places to go. Wives have decorated the tents all so nicely.
And they got to pick up, move. They've gotten used to it. You know, maybe some of you just moved here a year ago. You feel pretty settled. You're used to things in a year. You know where Smith's is now. You know where the quickest Best Buy is now. You're used to things. And so they pick up and move, and they grumble about the adversity. It's hard. You bet it's hard picking up and being a sojourner in the wilderness when you've gotten used to hanging out in a camp. And they grumble. And before, when they used to be able to provide for themselves almost at the base of Mount Sinai, so there's not much mention of manna when they're at the base of Mount Sinai, now they're forced to rely upon God. Remember, manna was this bread that just fell from the sky. Every morning, they'd come out in magic heaven bread was already on the ground. And they could have as much of it as they wanted. They could make it into paste if they wanted. They could do things with it if they wanted. God didn't prohibit that, but it's just today's. At the end of the day, the manna expires. It gets moldy. It shrivels up. It goes away. You can only get today's manna, even if you want to eat a lot of manna. And so now they're back on the manna train, you could say. They're back out in the wilderness needing God's miracle food. Oh, great. They complain. We remember this. We remember this on the other side of Mount Sinai. This stuff is plain. Could kill for some peanut butter. Just some sort of spread, some cream cheese, some Einstein schmear, something, please. No. Really, what they say, they would give anything for some meat. They're complaining for meat. The other side of the mountain, man, you could get a quail. You could go fishing, maybe. You could find something of substance. This is the opposite of the Atkins diet. You know the no-carb diet? This is the all-carb diet. They're eating just manna. Man, need some meat. And God, amazingly, in his patience, actually gives them meat. So look at chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, where we see their greed, their complaint, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish we used to eat when we were free in Egypt." Egypt? What God rescued you from? "We remember the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and onions and the garlic. Yes, we were in bondage to Pharaoh and we had to work hard, but at least we ate good. Now our appetite is gone. There's nothing for us to look at." Look at. Notice the bitterness there. "I'm sick of looking at manna." And God is angry. He gives them quail. Chapter 11, verse 31. "There went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea." The passage actually goes on to say that while they're eating, God kills them. It's almost ironic. "I'll give you what you want, and then I'll kill you." But the complaint is bad. They complain against their provision. They complain against the leader, Moses. Look at chapter 12, verse 2. This is Aaron and Miriam. This is like number two on the camp. And listen what they say about Moses. "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it, and the Lord was mad. And the Lord pulled Miriam and Aaron into the camp and gave them a talking to. And if it were not for Moses' intervention in the rest of chapter 12, God likely would have killed Miriam for her complaint against Moses. But God spares her life and makes them put her out of the camp for 7 days to teach her a lesson. So the third major theme here, as you can anticipate, is one of judgment. Judgment. In chapter 11, verse 1, God killed because of grumbling.
In chapter 11, verse 33, God killed because of grumbling. In chapter 20, God kills because of grumbling, complaining, murmuring. In chapter 21, God sends serpents to disease the people, as it were, because of their grumbling and complaint. Are you getting the picture? God hates complaint, and he's killing thousands at a time. At one place in chapter 21, it says God sent serpents to kill, quote unquote, many of the people. Many of the people. Many. Many, many. Where's that in the Bible? Abraham, you'll be a father of many. You'll be the father of many nations. You'll be the father of many people. Many. God's killing many? Wasn't one of the promises that your seed would be many? And now God is subtracting? Do you realize that? Do you realize that God's plan here is running temporarily contrary to his promises? That's how serious it is. Temporarily, he says, I promised you'd grow, but because of complaint right now, you're going to shrink. Thousands at a time. Imagine. Thousands at a time. In 9/11, we lost 5,000 people and a nation mourned. This is a group one-third the size of Denver with the promises that they're supposed to grow and be many because God is working in them. And God shrinks them down by thousands because of complaining? Oh, brothers and sisters, do you know how wicked, how insidious complaining is to a God who is sovereign and wise and good? Write those three down if you would. God is sovereign, he is wise, and he is good. And those are three tectonic plates that move in harmony and shift together. He is sovereign, he is wise, and he is good. And complaining always questions one of those. To complain is to say to God, you're not good right now. You don't know what's best right now. Or if we don't say it to God, then we say he's not sovereign right now. Oh, beware of models of theology in which God is not sovereign. Beware of new models, quote unquote, like open theism or open theology that say God doesn't know the future. He's not in control over actions and lives, decisions and paths. And so you can complain and he complains with you. God shut our mouths and God guard our minds to never believe such a thing, because here, the very fact that they complain is the very fact that he judges. The two are connected. He judges because they complain. And it's an affront to his sovereignty. It's an affront to his wisdom. It's an affront to his goodness, to his love, to his promises. It questions the very nature of God. To question his goodness or his wisdom in any circumstances, to dare shake our fists in the air, whether physically or just in our hearts, and say, why? Is a wicked thing. And God kills thousands in the book of Numbers, thousands of his people whom he promised to grow and be many. He kills them and reduces them because of complaint and grumbling. And not just once, but many, many times. Complaint says to God, what in the world is wrong with you? Complaint says to God, are you stupid or just evil? You say, Ryan, how can you say that? No, that's not the question. The question is not how we can say to God, are you stupid or just evil? The question is how we complain and not think that and not realize that that's what it means. That's not what it speaks to God. Oh, if he's sovereign and good and wise, then we must put our hands over our mouths like Job and be still and know that he is God. The sheer numbers of God's judgment in the book of Numbers tells us something about how serious he takes this. When we keep in mind that the book of Exodus laid out for us 30-some times, I have done this that you may know that I am God. To come to Numbers and to grumble against the Lord's provision, to grumble against the Lord's leading and direction, to grumble against his wilderness, to grumble against his timing, is to forget that he is God. Remember 1 Corinthians 10? Turn back there if you would. This is a passage that Paul uses, both quoting from Exodus and the book of Numbers, to remind us of God's judgment. 1 Corinthians 10 in verse 4. All drank the same spiritual drink from which they were drinking. From that spiritual rock which followed them, that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. That's an understatement. For they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, that we would not crave evil things as they craved. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it was written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. That's from Exodus. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. Take heed, brothers. And sisters, God hates complaint. And he hates the fourth major theme in Numbers 2, and that's unbelief. Unbelief. Chapter 13 records for us God's commandment to send spies into the land of Canaan to see what they're up against. Remember, you count the army to see what you're up against. So look at chapter 13, verses 18 and 19. God says to them, "See what the land is like. Whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, and whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps, or are they with fortifications?" So for 40 days, God sends spies out into the wilderness to look at Canaan, to see what it's like, to know what they're up against. This is good, wise war strategy. It's typical. They come back and they give, except for two of the spies, a negative report. Look at verse 32, chapter 13. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they'd spied out. Negative. "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. They're tough, they're merciless, and all the people whom we saw in it are of men of great size." They give a doubtful response. "It doesn't look good, guys. It doesn't look promising. They have more people. They have bigger people. They're merciless people. The city is fortified and secure." But Joshua and Caleb, two of the spies, didn't doubt. Instead, they plead with the people. They plead with the people in chapter 14, verses 6 to 9. Look at these words. "Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, they tore their clothes, they repented, they were in anguish about what they heard. For they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. And if the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.'" And so here's where we come to the heart of the matter for the book of Numbers, the book of censuses, the book of countings, we could say. Why count? Well, humanly speaking, you count to know whether you should go into battle. whether it's wise to go into battle. But with God, God shakes that up. They do not pass the test. Only Joshua and Caleb get it. God had them spy out, not so that they would feel self-confident, so that they would be rather more God-confident. They're not supposed to be greater than the Canaanites. They're not supposed to be stronger than the Canaanites. If that were the case, then the victory would be Israel's, not the God of Israel's. What makes us feel strong? God here is kicking out every crutch to show them that they must rely on Him, that He must bring it to pass, that He is your survival, that there's no such thing in Him as self-survival. Whether that be in the self-survival of your crops at the base of Mount Sinai, or your fishing in Egypt, or your hard work in Egypt, your provision must be seen as miracle bread like manna. And you cannot go into this land thinking you are self-secure, self-sustained, that your self-survival will be in your own strength. He will kick out that crutch. What makes us feel strong? What makes us confident? What gives you a good night's sleep? A well-loaded shotgun under the bed? A security system no one can thwart? Locked doors? Really tough husband like me.
That's a joke.
Or is it God? There is nothing wrong with a shotgun or big biceps or locking your doors or having security systems, but if your trust is in one rather than the other, then it is idolatry and not worship. Do you see? You've replaced God. That's what idolatry is. Idolatry isn't just carved statues. It's having any other God. And so if your strength is in the legs, if your strength is in the horse, if your strength is in the sword, if your strength is in the numbers, then your strength isn't in God, and you have set up a false God. Either it's idolatry or it's worship, and God is bringing them to worship. So Joshua and Caleb plead for the people, but how do they respond? Look at chapter 14, verse 10. All the congregation said to stone them with stones. Whoa. That is a hard-hearted people, isn't it? They go with the majority here. Majority said, they're big, they're bad, they'll kill us, we're in trouble. Okay, we doubt here. They've forgotten that this is the God who, when they were not a fortified army, when they had no weapons, and they stood at the brink of the Red Sea with a Egyptian army coming to kill them, God parted the way. They walked on dry ground. And oh no, hurry up. They can go through the dry ground too and get us on the other side, but God brings the waves crashing down on the Egyptian army, killing them and saving His people. This is the God that they serve. This is the God they serve that rains manna and puts water in a rock and saves them and reveals His power in a quaking Mount Sinai of fire and smoke. They doubt. They doubt the fact that God has said already, when you go in, I will confound them. When you go in, I'll make you strong and them weak. They'll be stupid. They'll be confused. They'll be taken by surprise. Don't worry about it. But they look at the outward. And so the fifth theme is postponement. Before we get to think about their specific postponement, think about yours. God will teach you the same lesson over and over. If you don't get it and you still have your crutches, He will keep kicking them out.
He will make you lower than you thought you could go until you get it. And we all understand that until heaven, we never fully get it. But we all know that sometimes we hang on to this precious idol of self-sufficiency more than we should and more than we could. And God will take a job out of the way to show us that it's not in the strength of resumes or experience. God will take the strength out of our human bodies to show us that it's not in your ability to do. And he will keep kicking crutches out as long as they are idols. Because he is God and he's a jealous God. And he wants strength in your life to be his strength. And he would rather have you humble and holy than rich and secure. His purposes aren't ours. And so if you wonder, why does it feel like I'm kicking against the goads? Why does it feel like I can't just get a step up? Maybe it's because the Lord is teaching you a lesson about your crutches. For them, it meant you don't get to go to the promised land. No second chances for them. Because of their unbelieving and grumbling, a whole generation will die out before they enter in. 40 years they will wander around in the wilderness. 40 years. Why 40? Well, 40 years is a generation, but also because 40 years, 1 year for every day, your spies went out and spied. That's the heart of the matter here. Your spies went out and did not believe. And the whole congregation, instead of siding with Joshua and Caleb, was ready to pick up stones against them to not go into the land, to not be killed by the sword, to not trust God. And so there is postponement. The sixth theme here is rebellion. There are different themes of rebellion. There is in chapter 16, the rebellion of Korah. Chapter 22 gives us the sneakiness of Balaam the prophet. Bill Anderson some time ago preached on these and did a great job. I encourage you to get the CD if you want to think more about the rebellion of Korah and Balaam. But look at chapter 25 where we see the sin of idolatry, the rebellion of idolatry in the people. This is the heart of the issue here. This is where it gets the most ugly, we could say. In chapter 25, verse 1, while all Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot. This is a theme that starts to be developed in the rest of the whole Bible, playing the harlot with God because you're married to him. They played the harlot with the daughters of Moab. They married the wrong people. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods, so Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor. And the Lord was angry against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord. Some question whether God will be in hell. Some verses say you're apart from the presence of the Lord, 2 Thessalonians 1. Some verses say, Revelation 14, it will be in the presence of the Lamb and of his holy angels. Which is it? God will be in hell. But only in his wrath and indignation. There will be nothing of his goodness, mercy, love, patience. They are in hell. It will only be his wrath. And we see this here in one small picture that this is done before the presence of the Lord. In verse 4, look at verse 9. Those who died by the plague that God put on them were 24,000. 24,000. God hates complaining, and God hates idolatry. Those are the two biggies in Numbers. He hates complaining, and he hates idolatry. But oh, a seventh theme is that there is salvation with this God. There is salvation. There's salvation in bread from the sky, the manna. So that John 6 develops this theme, I leave you to yourself to go and search John 6 for this theme of Jesus being the bread of life that pointed to back to the manna that saved them temporarily. Jesus is the manna that comes down from the sky that saves you eternally. Jesus is water from the rock, so that in chapter 20, verse 8, Moses is told to hit a rock to provide water for the people. He just hits a rock with a stick. Water comes out of a rock. Water's not supposed to come out of rocks. You know those fountains you have in your front yard where the fountain's coming out of a rock? Yeah, they did that. That was man-made. Waters don't come from rocks, do they? Unless God does a miracle to provide for his people. And Jesus says, I'm that rock. I'm that water. And when you drink of this water, you're not saved temporarily. You're saved eternally. Or the bronze serpent, quickly, chapter 21 of Numbers, verses 6 through 9, say this. The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many of the people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses, and they said, we've sinned because we've spoken against the Lord. Notice repentance and confession. Intercede with the Lord that he might remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded. And the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard or a pole. This is the medical symbol. You've seen it, the staff. The serpent wrapped around it. This is the be healed symbol, we could say. And if the serpent bit any man, when he looks at the bronze serpent, he lives. Looks. That's it. That's easy. That's it. That's all you got to do. You don't have to go up to the bronze serpent and then rub it on your back and get rid of the sores and, all right, and swallow it. And no, there's no to-do list. You just look. It's a symbol of faith. Just look. And in John 12, Jesus said, if I be lifted up on the cross, wrapped around the wood of that staff, if anyone looks to me, he'll be saved. If I be lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. Lifted up. Again, it's the connection. Jesus is pointing us back to an Old Testament symbol of temporary salvation to show us that he is the eternal fulfillment of salvation. Praise God indeed. The last major theme is anticipation. The last chapters of Numbers leave specific instruction for the people on how to prepare. The generation has died off. There's still, I'm sure, pockets of unbelief. There's still pockets of grumbling. I mean, you can't stop complaining. You just try it. You see how long you can go. I tried this week knowing when I was preaching on, all right, I'm going to do good. I'm not going to complain. Oops, I complained. You know. But now the difference is they believe. And the proof that they believe is this. God has them take a second census. The first census, the army was 603,550. The second census, 40 years later, 601,730, almost 2,000 less. God says, you thought you were in trouble with 603,000? Let's bump it down a couple. A generation later, they should have grown. This tells us just how much God was wiping people out, doesn't it? They're now 2,000 less, despite the prolific commandment to be fruitful and multiply that Israel was pretty good at. They're always having 10 kids, and you know he's got 15, and she's got 8, and okay. They're 2,000 less because God's wiping them out. And he says, there, now you're ready. There's no mention of whether Canaan is any less strong. And it's just where he wants them. So what we see in the book of Numbers is that God is God. Complaint and unbelief are insidious and wicked because he's the God of Exodus who says, I have done this that you may know I'm God. He's the God over all creation because he made it and it's his right. He is the God over sin and rebellion and unbelief, and he's not threatened by our inadequacies. He's the God of salvation, the mercy to offer and the plan to accomplish it and the symbols for how he will represent it. He's God over judgment and justice. He's God over life and death to give it and to take it away. He is God to drop quail to the ground, and he is the God who will drop you to the ground, if need be, for his glory. He is the God who is loving and gracious to provide, and he is the God who will severely and justly punish for his namesake. He is the God who will plan to redeem, to restore, to renew, and to regenerate. He is the God who takes lives and leads them and directs them and thwarts their plans and their efforts and their self-sufficiencies. He is a God who is not made with human hands as though he needed anything, Acts 17 says. And so he is God. He is God.